Here's Elise Klink, the owner of ThinkLink Media and Best Money Moves. Welcome back, Elise. How are you?
I'm good, thank you, John. Had a nice weekend?
Let me think. Did I? Yeah, although it was kind of weird because we just got back from an overseas trip, Steve Bertrand trip with WGN Radio listeners. So we got back into the U.S. of A. Saturday around 5 in the afternoon. And, you know, those trips to London or wherever, really 24-hour days. So then you sort of fight to stay up as late as you can so you can kind of get back into the sleep groove, you know?
Yeah, it's tough, but totally worth it to go abroad and have those experiences. I love the idea of traveling.
I do, too. And it's always the same thing. When you get there, you do the zombie walk for about a day. Your body readjusts and you wonder, why the hell are we doing this? And then the next day, you're in London and it's great. So all good. You are paying attention a little bit to the funding of Secret Service and some stuff like that, which sounds political in nature. We normally ask you about money issues. What's the connection here for you?
Well, you know, we're all watching what happens with the government, the federal government being shut down. And we're getting a little bit close to that limit. And there were a whole lot of politics around, as there always are, keeping the government funded through, you know, at least the election. And so what was interesting to me about this, John, is that the only thing that they were able to do was to add $230 million to the funding for a special resolution to fund Secret Service. And I think what they're trying to do is just have a clean 3-month continuing resolution to fund the government straight through, continuing what we're doing. They're not going to add anything to it. They're not going to take anything away. The only thing was to boost the funding for Secret Service so that they could protect everybody who needs to be protected, and that is just a very large group of people.
When does the funding for the government expire right now?
I believe it is supposed to expire September 30th, which would be next week. So there is some urgency to get this passed. Speaker Johnson had put through a new bill, I think it was last night, after the House failed on Wednesday to pass a 6-month government funding plan. And that included some politically controversial measures that included things like targeting non-citizen voting, right? But all that got wiped away, and it's very clean now. And the expectation is that it will pass and that we will fund the government through only December 20th. So we get through the election and a couple of weeks past, it's right before Christmas, which is, of course, a very tough time. And then we'll see what happens because we'll be inaugurating a new president come January.
Talk to me about FHFA conforming loan limits. I saw some of the stuff you were sharing with Pete, and I'm also interested in what happens to people's payments as the interest rates go up and down. Let's start there. Talk to me a little bit about conforming loans.
Yeah, so a conforming loan is one that can qualify for the least expensive interest rates because basically the government, through the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA, it'll back it, and the expectation is it will back it through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So the secondary mortgage market depends on Fannie and Freddie buying the vast majority of loans out there. And so to do that, you have to qualify up to that level that they're willing to do. And so the baseline amount for 2024, for this year, for the contiguous 48 states, District of Columbia, and Puerto Rico was $766,550. In other words, you could get a loan up to that amount and still qualify for conforming interest rates, which is great. Now, for high-cost areas and for up to 4-unit apartment buildings where you live in one and you rent out the other 3, you actually could qualify for up to almost $1.5 million. I think the number this year was $1.474 million. So that's a conforming loan. Non-conforming means you fall outside of the realm of whatever, you know, the conforming loan limits are. And so if you get a loan for, let's say, $2 million or you're buying a 6-unit apartment building or some other sort of thing, then it's non-conforming and typically you pay higher interest rates.
Is some of this contingent upon you being a good credit risk?
Well, of course, you have to have good credit. But what's nice about a conforming loan is even if you don't have the best level of credit, you're still qualifying for one of these Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac loan programs. So you might pay a little bit higher interest rate, but right. you're going to qualify for the program, and that overall will be less expensive than a non-conforming loan.
Speaking of home numbers, we're visiting with Elise Glink, owner of Think Glink Media. Are you hearing stories about houses that don't appraise at what the buyer and seller have agreed to, Elise?
There are some stories like that. And part of the reason that we're seeing that happen is that home prices have been jumping up in Chicago right now more than almost, well, I won't say almost anywhere else in the country, but they've all, the rest of the country has already had its huge pop-ups.
Yeah.
But we're still seeing, you know, nice, better than average movement here in Chicago. And when that happens, what ends up happening is appraisers go out and they look at comparable homes that have sold. Well, when you're selling at above market and you're selling very, very rapidly, sometimes there aren't as many comps available as you would want. And appraisers who may or may not have a lot of experience and understand the differences between the homes may not portray it the right way back to the bank. And so that's why sometimes that happens.
The value of a home is worth whatever somebody's willing to pay for it. But if the bank doesn't agree to that number, then I assume the one of the parties has to then come up with the difference if you're going to have to borrow the money to buy the house, right?
One party has to either come up with more money, that would be the borrower, or the seller's got to drop the price. And you never want to see that happen because in a true marketplace, right, if you know somebody's willing to pay for it, that's what it should be worth. But the lenders need some sort of confirmation, external confirmation, because otherwise you'd have shill buyers going in there and just bidding it up and, you know, there'd be no balance to the marketplace. So it is a bit of a concern, though, when you see, you know, you start to see the number of people getting refused for loans simply because the value has popped up more than, say, the automated lending, technology says it should, for example. But one thing that's going to help that, I think, at least help people qualify, is the fact that the 30-year fixed-rate mortgage dropped to just above 6% the other day. A year ago, John, almost 7.2%. Now it's at 6%, and it's looking like it's going to continue to drop farther. And this is, of course, because last week, the Federal Reserve Bank dropped the federal funds rate by 0.5%. And the markets rallied, and that's why we're seeing good stock numbers and lower interest rates this week.
So it'll either be lower mortgage payments or maybe the same mortgage payment, but you're able to buy more house.
Exactly. And, I wanted everybody to know, because you might think that 1% in drop in the interest rate from, say, 7.2% to 6.2 or 6% wouldn't be that significant. But let me give you a real-life example of how much this changes things. So take a $425,000 house, which is about the average home price in the U.S., and let's say you have a 20% down payment. Well, at a 6% rate, you're going to be paying $2,400 a month, and at 7.2%, you're going to be paying a little over $2,650 a month. That's almost $250 a month more, or $3,000 a year more in interest on the mortgage.
And then over the life of a loan, then you're talking bigger numbers still, obviously.
Yeah, like $100,000. And I don't know about you, but I can think of a lot of things to do with $100,000.
Are we building more houses? Is more stock coming out?
Well, not as much as I would have hoped. So LendingTree took a look at the construction statistics numbers, and they found that construction really stagnated this year. So nationwide, we saw 878,000 housing units authorized to begin construction. That was January through July. It's a little bit of an increase from the same period a year ago, not even 2%. About 600,000 of those are single-family homes, and the rest are kind of mid-size multifamily buildings or large multifamily buildings. And that includes rental units as well as homes for purchase or condos. So what you're seeing is that it's kind of stagnated. And when you look at where it's all happening, not a surprise, Texas, Florida, and California saw the most of it. Illinois, we're number 24 in the country. So we're building, But again, nobody's building nearly as much as we need to.
Is it the borrowing cost? Is it a labor issue? Why aren't we getting more homes on the market?
Check E, all of the above. Labor shortages. We don't have the qualified people to build it. We're still seeing global supply chain problems because not everything that needs to go into a house is made in this country. Raw materials are tough to get. High borrowing costs, right, over the last year, now coming down, that should help. But also, we've got hurdles that are created by really restrictive zoning and construction regulations. And that has made it really difficult for builders to come up with the cash needed to sort of get through the zoning process and to get started. So we have a number of issues that we have to resolve in order to get things going.
Elise Glink is the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves, thinkglink.com. We'll talk next Monday, Elise.
Always a pleasure, John.
Jim Dahlke joins us a lot of Mondays at this time. Here he is again, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Hi, Jim. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about battery maker NanoGraph. Who are they? What's the story?
Yeah, this is a Chicago startup, NanoGraph. They make advanced materials for batteries. Their goal really is to make batteries lighter and last longer. And they just got $60 million in federal grant funding to open a new facility in Flint, Michigan. So this new facility is going to make batteries for consumer devices and for the military based on this new facility. We've talked about NanoGraph in the past. They also have worked extensively with the military, helping create batteries for radios and other equipment that military personnel use in the front lines. NanoGraph really has a wide range of uses for its batteries. It can be used in handheld devices, power tools, and even think electric vehicles. There's a lot of use cases for NanoGraph here, and this is a startup that's landed quite a bit of funding, not just venture capital, but also grants from the Department of Defense, as well as federal grants, especially for this facility in Flint. So some pretty big moves here from NanoGraph as they plan to open this several million-dollar facility out in Flint, Michigan.
Well, as much as you hear about chips, I think batteries are a limitless growth area. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're very closely tracking the growth of electrification. It's really a matter of if not when. And so that's where, the industry is headed. And certainly NanoGraph is playing a big piece of that. And so, this new facility is going to create about 150 new jobs in Flint, Michigan as well. So, of course, that's great for the area. And, NanoGraph is really continuing to grow its battery technology in lots of different sectors. So definitely a startup to watch.
I was here's a shout out to one of our sponsors, the folks that make Echo Power Tools. And I don't know if NanoGraph is going to help businesses like that make even more efficient power tools still. But oh my gosh, the power and charge you get these days compared to what you used to get is evident the minute you operate those things,
Absolutely. Yeah. Power tools is definitely a big piece of what their business is. And yeah, I can certainly echo that. I mean, I've definitely, purchased some lower end electric appliances like that where the batteries don't work well. And when you get one that actually does, it's a game changer.
Yeah, I'm going to get you one of those Echo weed whackers. It'll change your life. You'll be looking for weeds just for the pleasure of whacking them. Okay. Andy Dunn, who is he? Why is he in your news?
Yeah, Andy Dunn. This is the founder of a menswear company, Bonobos. This was a popular menswear startup sold to Walmart back in the day. Andy is now in Chicago leading a new startup called Pi. This is a company, really a consumer startup aiming to help you make friends. It sounds pretty simple, but they have an interesting approach here. They're really the goal is to get folks who are likely to connect, or likely to get along, and put them in group settings. And so Pi learns a little bit about you, about your interests, about your personality, kind of what you're looking for and from a group of friends, and it can help you set up basically different group friend outings. This is a startup that just raised $11.5 million, so a little money in the bank here as this company looks to grow. They're only live in Chicago right now, but folks in Chicago can check it out, and they hope to expand to other cities in the future. But, they're taking an interesting approach, and this is a business really born out of COVID. Andy Dunn was somebody who, came back to Chicago from New York City sort of during the pandemic. He, you know, dealt with his own issues of mental health and bipolar disorder, and you know, really was, you know, trying to get a, you know, a better clean bill of health, and also get out of his house and meet people and make friends, and really was sort of struggling to find an easy way to do that. So really, you know, Andy really believes that Pi is an opportunity to, you know, get folks out of their house, you know, out in the real world and make new friends.
It's funny that I'm just canvassing my mind here to think of all of the different social media platforms. There's not one out there that's already saying, hey, are you interested in, I don't know, some hobby or activity? Let's all get together and do it. Somebody's not doing that already?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely competitors in this space. So, I mean, certainly if you look at the big companies, the Facebooks of it all, the Instagrams of it all, you know, kind of at their core, right? They say they're like, hey, we're helping people connect. But really, at the end of the day, like, Facebook wants to keep you on Facebook. Instagram wants to keep you on Instagram.
On the platform,
what Pi wants to do is help connect you and then get you off your computer and out into the real world. So certainly there are other, you know, kind of event apps and meetup apps that are trying to do that. But, you know, Pi really is not trying to increase engagement on its app. It's more like get you on the app and then get you off.
One last question about that. So what would some of the activities be that we're all getting together for?
Yeah. So, I mean, it could be, you know, yoga in the park. You know, it could be bowling. It could be, you know, a different kind of exercise class or running group. You know, it really kind of runs the gamut. So, you know, it really could be any kind of activity. But, you know, what's really interesting here is that, you know, Chicago historically has not been the type of city that produces startups like this. Chicago's a very business-to-business tech town. Lots of startups are built around kind of the business environment, not so much consumer. Cameo, of course, you know, was, you know, the big breakout consumer app, you know, that launched here several years ago. But, you know, those examples are few and far between in terms of a pure sort of consumer social media app. So interesting to see if Pi will be able to break through. And, you know, definitely they're, you know, led by a seasoned startup founder who's kind of been there, done that on the consumer side. So interesting to see if they'll be able to crack the code here with Pi.
Okay, we'll leave it at that and talk about more business startups next week with Jim Dahlke, the Director of Communications at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Nice to talk to you, Jim.
Thanks, John.
Let's update you on other things happening in the business world with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago startup that focuses on shipping reports a successful funding round. Cold Cart raised $6.5 million in seed funding and will use the cash to expand its platform across more frozen and refrigerated shippers and logistic providers. The company helps make shipping cold products easier. Cold Cart helps find clients the best routing, packaging, and shipping while considering cost, on-time delivery, weather, and provider availability. It's been focusing on direct-to-consumer food and beverage delivery, but plans to expand into pharmaceutical products. Cold Cart's founders are Chicago Tech veteran Jason Park and Blue Apron founder Matt Salzberg. World Business Chicago is hosting a week-long conference this week called Future of FinTech Week. The event will focus on the future of finance technology in Chicago. Industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and investors in FinTech will gather to focus on growing the sector locally. Chicago Inno says FinTech activity has been trending up in the past year after peaking in 2021. Activity in the sector has fluctuated in actual activity and deal size. World Business Chicago sponsors several programs aimed at attracting growth capital for local entrepreneurs. The conference runs through Friday. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and let's begin with the food calendar today. It's National Pot Pie Day, something the Tavern on Rush was not known for before it closed at the end of 2022. I don't know whether pot pie will be on the new Tavern on Rush menu, but you can find out beginning today.
It took months to do this deal.
And Chicago restaurant legend Phil Stefani says it took many more months to renovate a space just across Bellevue from where the original tavern reign for 25 years and turn it into a new and bigger Tavern on Rush.
It's 16,000 square feet, and across the street I had about 9,000 square feet.
More from Phil after I thank the Chevy Silverado for picking up the check today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome back to Phil Stefani and his restaurant, one of the icons of Chicago's Viagra Triangle.
25 years ago, we opened up Tavern on Rush on Rush and Bellevue.
And after a year and a half break, Tavern on Rush is back today at Rush and Bellevue, directly across the street from the old one. It'll occupy two floors where Nico's restaurant used to be in the Thompson Hotel, plus the patio.
Yes, you need a patio. People want to eat outside. And even though it's not the seasons that, you know, California has, I did watch back in the days a tavern where people sat out there in pretty cold weather.
Stefani says the new Tavern on Rush will try to bring back the nostalgia and energy and all the charm that people remember from the old one. But he says the restaurant business has changed a lot.
It's a very, very difficult business. It's just, you know, and then now, especially with food costs and labor costs and everything rising, it's becoming much more of a challenge.
The Stefani Restaurant Group now has 13 restaurants and Phil's keys to success?
My people know what they're doing, I guess. As much as I get all the credit, the point is that without staff, you don't fly the airplane. The staff makes you what you are, and I've been very fortunate through the years.
And they're planning to bring back many of the former staff members from the original location at the new tavern, still on Rush, just a different corner, opening today. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Robert's Pizza. We talked about that on the Wintrust Business Lunch before, because that... I want to say hidden gem, although it's not really hidden, but it's not right on Michigan Avenue. But that gem of a pizza place last we talked about was nominated as one of the best pizza places in the world. So Robert Garvey was going to head out there with his wife to check on, to go to an awards ceremony and see how they did. And they are in our studio now. Dana Hoken and Robert Garvey from Robert's Pizza and Dough Company in the studio. Welcome back. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having us on. Yeah. It's nice to be here.
When'd you get back, Dana?
We got back Thursday. So
this is hot off the presses.
It is.
And still a little jet lagged.
Yeah. Well, I know the feeling, but congratulations. So what was the award? Where did you finish? What happened?
So this is, they ranked the top 100 pizzas of the world, and we came in at number 50, which we were very excited about and very pleased and honored, in fact, to have that.
And who did the awarding or judging, or how does this happen?
It's called 50 Top Italy. It's an organization based in Naples, and they rank pizzas all around the world, including the U.S. I think they represent about 40 different countries that they rank pizzas in. And here in the U.S., we were selected as number 10 of the top 50. And then they take the best of their... of all their lists around the world, and they put together the top 100, and we came in at 50 on that. So,
is it broken down into categories, thick, thin, Chicago style? I don't know.
No, just pizza. I mean, most of it is a quasi Neapolitan style pie. A lot of the ovens that they use are wood burning ovens. We happen to use a gas fired brick oven. But we get a very similar quality pizza.
Would you say then that the pizza that is most consumed around the world is not a Malnati's thick Chicago-style pizza, but something with a thinner crust?
I think the thinner crust is more widely seen around the world, but there's nothing wrong with a Malnati's thick crust pizza. That's a great pie.
So. For those who haven't been to Robert's, then, describe your pizza.
My pizza is an artisan-style pie. It is a thin crust with a sourdough, a 25-year-old sourdough starter. And then I do a 2 to 3 day ferment, so I get this great artisan bread flavor in our crust. So it's a little chewy, it's a little crunchy, and it's got that great great bread flavor.
And it's the original yeast from 25 years ago?
25 years ago, we created it in our house, just kind of playing around as a hobby. And basically this wild yeast in a year, we were able to capture it in about 6 to 8 weeks. But the real hard work comes for the keeping it alive, which means it needs to be fed every day. So somehow we managed to feed that starter every day for the last 25 years.
So it really is a relative of that original dough, the flavor, the texture.
Oh, yes.
By that specific yeast. Do you have nightmares like, oh, my God, I forgot to feed the yeast?
When we first opened up, we had a couple of close calls. One of the dishwashers didn't realize we had emptied the bucket for the day. Not completely emptied, but used it. And the dishwasher thought it was done and was about to wash it away. And I just happened to step back in, and I saved it. So.
Don't do that. Did you sample other pizzas then from around the world when you were out there, Dana?
Well, we had the opportunity to sample a bunch of pizzas in Naples, and I think that was part of our on our to-do list. It was a, I think we ate four or five different Neapolitan-style pizzas while we were in Naples, and what was remarkable was really just the difference between each pizza and the creativity of the ingredients that are used on these pizzas.
For instance?
Which was the one that you really...
some incredible salamis and prosciuttos, yeah. And egg. They had a terrific eggplant.
And the different tomatoes. Right. You know, tomatoes that we don't get here. There's just the flavor profile was just really, they were very sweet. And in some cases, very tangy as well. There was just a really, and the cheeses were incredible. Mm. And then we sampled different olive oils and then had the opportunity to explore a vineyard along the Amalfi Coast area.
Oh, yeah, sure, sure.
And that was pretty exciting.
What a great work trip.
That was one of the nice things about being nominated for the list is just being able to go over to Naples and kind of enjoy the culture there and try all these pizzas, have some great wine, meet a lot of other pizzaiolis, and it was a lot of fun.
Robert's Pizza judged in the top 10 in the United States and number 50 in the world. Did you sample number one, or who is the champion?
Number one is actually in New York City. It's Anthony Mangieri at Una Pizza. Who I did have his pizza. I know Anthony. I did have his pizza years ago when he was on 11th Street in New York. And now he has since moved and has another place in Manhattan.
You said Una, not Uno.
No,
we have in Chicago Una.
Right.
And
Una
what's pizza. What's Una pizza like?
He does a wood burning oven Neapolitan style pizza. Just a terrific, really terrific pie, and a great guy too.
It's nice that you guys seem to. Share the enthusiasm for what I would believe to be your competitors or people who maybe aren't doing it the way you do it, but you're happy for the club, it sounds like.
That's true. We, every year there's a big expo out in Vegas called Pizza Expo, and everybody gets together, and it's just great to trade recipes, stories, etc.
Is there a trend in the business right now? Is it going a certain direction, would you say? I'm talking about ingredients or styles or anything like that.
I think that the thin, from what I'm seeing, is that there's a lot of thin crust pizza. There's a lot of wood burning oven pizza. Seems to be what a lot of people are doing at the moment. We're doing something a little bit different. We're using the brick oven, and it's a little bit of a different pie, but it's got a little more chew to it than the
others. Yeah,
And I think there's a real strong awareness for the craft. You know, not just the folks making pizza, but our customers and I mean people that we meet around the world, just the appreciation for the craft, and I think that's a trend that may not have been there few years back. That awareness of that.
Well, pizza is the sort of thing that a lot of people can do, but maybe not everybody does well, and therein lies the craft. I always quote Phil Vitale, the longtime restaurant critic at the Tribune, who championed your crust and the craft of your pizza all the time. And those of us who have gone there can certainly attest to that. So congratulations to number 50 worldwide. So are you like now going to be number 49 next year?
we're definitely going to work on it. But I must admit, to be anywhere on the list, to be recognized,
how's
is
business,
just an incredible
by the way.
Honor. It's great. We've been very busy. We had a great summer. The Chicago summer this year was incredible. The weather was extraordinary. And with that outdoor patio on the water is just incredible.
Yeah, I could see it from where we're standing almost. What's the address for your business?
The Ogden Slip. It's 465 North McClurg, which is basically the corner of McClurg and Illinois.
Yeah, right downtown Chicago, about where we're standing right now. Well, congratulations to you both, Dana Hoken and Robert Garvey, the team that bring you Robert's Pizza and Dough. Thanks for coming in and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.